Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Sound check on the radio. Sound check on the internet. Sound check with John Schaefer. He's the host.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Your brain is like a bunch of kids misbehaving in the back seat of the car while you try to drive. What? Don't look at me. I didn't make that up. Will Henschel did. He's the creator of an online music service that's supposed to help you focus. We'll ask him to explain himself later. Meanwhile, focus on this. It's not from a documentary, or at least not a conventional documentary.
If you were looking for a seat to go to the Bronx and you were on the train, you knew all the white people would be off in 96th Street, so you stood in front of white people to get on the train. Mm-hmm. That was a reality in my growing up. Right. So that's a whole other era that you don't know about. Where do you live now?
I live at 183 in Fort Washington.
The guy you hear somewhat sheepishly admitting that he lives way above 96th Street is Matt Davis. He's the guitarist and composer who leads the 10-piece band called Aerial Photograph, and he's in the middle of a big project called City of New York 2013, where he interviews people and then writes music inspired by them. We'll hear the music that this interview inspired a bit later on Soundcheck. But we'll begin with a real documentary. It's about something that irrevocably changed the music world, something so game-changing that the band Almost Famous wrote a song about it. That song is called Napster. The story of Napster is the story of the beginning of the end of the old model music business. Now, as we tell the story, we get word that for the first time since 1999, music sales worldwide actually went up last year. It was only 0.3%, but still, it's a good sign. And what is driving this tiny but telltale shift in music sales? It's digital music services like iTunes and online subscription sites like Spotify. Quite a turnaround from the panic that gripped the industry at the start of the digital age, which is when our Napster story begins. And here to tell us that story is Alex Winter. You may know him as an actor in films like The Lost Boys and Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, but he directed the new documentary called Downloaded. It premiered yesterday at the South by Southwest Festival in Austin. Alex, glad you could be with us.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
So the idea that 10 years later, finally, digital sales are actually helping music. The thing I take away from your documentary is just how frustrating it is that it took that long for this to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I was a big proponent of Napster, not from the sort of ethic piracy fight thing, but just as a very tech interested layman. I'd been searching around for internet communities since the early to mid 90s, BBS's newsgroups, things like that. And suddenly overnight, there was this radical evolution. It was almost unthinkable, the difference between the world before and after Napster in terms of music and global internet community. So, I honestly thought this would have been solved 10 years ago. Yeah, I'm amazed it's taking so long.
Now, it's interesting you use the words internet community, because when people think of Napster, they think of one thing: file sharing, piracy, music piracy, run rampant on the internet. What we find out is that the four guys who essentially start Napster started around music, but started as an internet community.
Absolutely. Yeah, music was really a delivery system for them. Their end game, the vision that Sean Fanning had when something popped into his head when he was 18 years old, was a global community. It wasn't file sharing. And he set out to code something that would bring people together. And he thought, what will bring them together? Music. And he, of course, he was a lover of music. And so that created a second problem. First, I've got to create a global internet community where no one's done one before. And then I've got to create a way to move music files around the internet, which no one's ever been able to do successfully before. And he did both. It's kind of extraordinary. Whether you love him or hate him, it was an extraordinary feat.
Mm-hmm. So of the four guys, Sean Fanning is the one who really creates what comes to be known as Napster.
Yes.
And he is obviously one of the main people that you talk to here. Downloaded is the name of the film. Alex Winter, the actor and the director behind this documentary about Napster. So no sooner do people sort of come to grips with what the internet is or can be than this thing happens that nobody is prepared for, perhaps least of all, the four guys who started Napster.
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, this really was I kind of look at now. I mean, maybe every youth revolt is this way. You maybe could say the same thing about the Beatles. Not that I completely, you know, contextually relate mm-hmm. these two. But, you know, this certainly has been a youth revolt. And there was a sort of what struck me that was interesting about telling these guys' story, even when I first got involved in it, was the crazy disparity between their brilliance and their naivete. I mean, it was shocking, frankly. Yeah. I mean, it's lovely in a way because that's how things get done. But that's, you know, it did throw a boulder in the water that there's absolutely no way they were prepared for.
There's a moment in the film Downloaded where Napster co-founder Sean Parker talks about those early days of the company.
It was one of the first times in history where you had this sort of pure youth revolution. Young, inexperienced, relatively unsophisticated but smart kids could create something entirely out of nowhere and revolutionize an industry that they frankly knew nothing about and had no relationships in. And this all happened, I think it probably 6 months passed before we ever had a conversation with anyone from the music industry. And it wasn't because we didn't want to have a conversation with anyone in the music industry. We just didn't know anyone in the music industry.
That's great. That is Sean Parker, who along with Sean Fanning and Ali Idar and Jordan Ritter are the four guys who started Napster, the notorious file-swapping music site, started in 1998. And 98 is really when, I mean, as this Sean says, they really were sort of feeling their way.
Absolutely.
At the time.
Yeah.
Why was the early internet, the internet 1.0, the 90s version, the perfect place, the perfect spot for a revolution like this?
I think it's exactly what you just said. I think that there were a lot of kids online. There were a lot of tech interested punters like myself online. But most people in the status quo or sort of the established business paradigms had no interest or awareness or understanding of the internet whatsoever. It was very clunky, very slow. For people like myself, it was an amazing place to inhabit. So basically the back door got left open. And the power of the internet, which we're just really seeing, I think, today in terms of, looking at CISPA and some of the other issues that are going on today and the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act and all
Thank
that
you.
is – sorry. I'll try not to descend into geek speak. These issues are real. And, you know, I think that now the slumbering giant has woken up and gone, oh, this isn't just about music sharing. This isn't just about global community like Facebook. This is about some pretty significant issues, and the internet is very powerful in a number of ways. We better start waking up and taking some action. And there are various forms of action, some good, some bad, that are being taken. But it's taken a very long time for people to catch up to the power of the internet. For those of us that got on it in the mid-90s, I think we were aware then and there that it had that kind of power.
Well, these four guys who start Napster meet on an IRC, an internet relay chat. And you'll need to explain what that is, I think, for people who are not teenagers in the mid-90s.
The IRC was one of several sort of core areas on the internet, communities on the internet, for lack of a better word. There are still some communities. IRC still exists. 4chan, there are still communities that are very reserved for hardcore net people that can really hack their way into anything. And again, that's, hackers' terms has become sort of criminalized, but Hacker was always a sort of a point of respect amongst the community of computer users all the way back to the
60s. It suggested you could write code.
Exactly, and... yeah. It was sort of, you know, your ability to fraternize anywhere in cyberspace. So, you know, that's where you could. And people like Fanning and Parker were able to really – they actually gained reputations in that space by the time they were 15, 16 years old that were formidable reputations.
And Sean Fanning's handle, his online handle, was Napster.
It was, yeah.
So it's very funny. There's a funny moment in the film Downloaded where one of the other guys – maybe it's Parker or one of the other founders – talks about Sean Fanning, you know, trying to get the music – sharing code to work, and he's asking them for advice, and they're saying, well, let's see the code. And he's like, nope, not going to show you the code.
Yeah, he was very proprietary of the source code. You know, I think he felt, you know, this was his idea. It was his lightning in a bottle moment, and he wanted to protect it.
Yeah. Now, there is a moment where two of the key players talk about their aha moment, their thunderbolt out of the blue, the realization of what you were just talking about, Alex, the possibilities of the internet with music. First, you'll hear Ian Rogers, who is now the CEO of Topspin Media, and then you'll hear Napster creator Sean Fanning.
You know, 1998 was when it really felt like, okay, this is real. This is the way I'm going to listen to music. It became clear that the computer was going to be the place that we would store our music. Then you started looking for tools to get the music into the computer, tools to play it back, tools to manage it.
I remember the first MP3 I ever downloaded, and I remember the first time I ever, you know, basically ever played a track from the internet. And I remember just thinking, even though it's just information, it's just audio, there's such a crazy amount of emotion. The fact that you could kind of share emotion over the internet, it was really wild to think that something so important to you, you could just trade so freely. So I think it was, you know, it's hard to quantify how important it was.
From the documentary Downloaded about Napster, that's, you heard the voice of Napster founder Sean Fanning, and before that, Ian Rogers. We're speaking with Alex Winter, the director behind the new documentary, which premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival in Austin on Sunday. And so it's 1998, they start Napster. How big, how fast?
You know, it's become this sort of Rashomon story, which is part of the fun of the doc, is everyone's got a different perspective on the past, however recent it may have been. You know, having been around Fanning, I was always amazed that, you know, he put it online and it exploded immediately amongst his community.
Uh-huh.
Everybody immediately, people like Ian Rogers, even at that time, pricked up their ears immediately and were like, this is watershed. This is 180 degrees inverted from where we've been up until this moment. You know, as Ali talks about in the movie, I think it took another year for the rest of the world to catch up. But as we said, I think in the clip you even played, you know, that was still those guys working on code. They got it to go from 30,000 users to 20 million, I think, within a few weeks.
Wow.
So it gives you a really – I mean, this is in the age of dial-up. This is not a broadband era.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's the – that kind of scale is almost impossible to comprehend today.
So 20 million users at a time when AOL had like 23 million
exactly.
users.
And they surpassed AOL within that month.
So we're talking about something that, you know, was in a kind of legal gray area. I mean, as far as the Napster guys were concerned, all they were doing was allowing people to share stuff that was on their computers.
Right.
Napster was not... I mean, they make this point, and you make the point in the film, they were not, you know, burning CDs and then distributing them. They were simply putting people in touch with other people and allowing them to share.
Yes.
That was not the safe harbor that they thought it would be. And, of course, one of your other jobs as the director of this movie is to go to the other side. And you spoke to everybody, it seems. I mean, all the Napster dudes, all the honchos at the record labels and stuff. What kind of reaction, how soon was it before the industry sort of looked over its shoulder and said, what the hell is that?
It took surprisingly long. You know, I think that the technology is still something that a lot of people from non-tech-oriented industries don't, just frankly, don't understand. I think some of the legislation we've seen When it has been, you know, shot down, is often just because it's the way it's written doesn't even comprehend how these decentralized file systems work. It wouldn't actually do anything to prevent anything. I think there's still a lot of ignorance in terms of how these technologies work. It took a long time for the labels to wake up and realize quite how big the genie was and quite how big the bottle was that it got out of.
So, you know, you had – we get to relive the sight of musicians like Alanis Morissette at congressional hearings and stuff, basically, you know, talking the company line about piracy and stuff like that. There's also – you speak with Don Einar. He's the former chairman of the Sony Music Label Group and Columbia Records. So he's one of the biggies. And here is his recollection of how the industry first began to respond to Napster.
The five global heads of the companies at the time most likely couldn't agree that today was Wednesday. And for different reasons, people had different ideas, people had different visions, and no one was used to this. And the word ambush happened a lot of times in the conversations that we had with everybody. The record business was kind of ambushed, however we want to look at it. And you got to deal with an ambush. You dealt with Pearl Harbor, you got to deal with it, right?
Wow. So he was not a happy camper.
No, I mean, you know, to have
your... He was ready to go to war.
Yes.
And he did.
They did, yes. They did, yeah.
So the lawsuit follows. There's one point where the Napster guys, you have this great footage of them from 98, 99, and then, of course, you've talked to them since then. In retrospect, they look back at that case and they think, wow, we really hired the wrong lawyer.
Yeah, I think that for them, you know, as you said, they really believed that they were doing something that fit under the umbrella, the safe harbor of, you know, the same thing Google does, which is just moving information around. Whether or not that's the case, it never got to the Supreme Court. The thing about Napster people don't know, it never went to trial, ever. They never had a trial. They had plenty of these sort of preliminary hearings, mm-hmm. and it died there. So we never got to, you know, they never got to determine. They may have lost. You know, it might have been decided, no, you don't have safe harbor. That's illegal. Go away. But we don't know that.
Yeah.
So, you know, certainly the record industry was, in their mind, had their entire infrastructure, you know, eroded from underneath them overnight. And I certainly, as you said, I talked to a lot of them because, you know, I used Napster, but I understood the legal gray areas. I wasn't, you know, I'd been around enough to understand mm-hmm. that it was very fuzzy. And I certainly had enormous sympathy for, you know, the record industry that I had grown up with and loved that didn't know what to do with this and was falling apart as a result. So it was important for me to really try to dig into the skin of that and let them communicate that perspective.
Right. Now, as an actor yourself, I mean, you know, if there had been, at the time of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, if there had been a way to download movies and to swap movie files for
yeah.
free, you know, would how might you have felt about that?
Yeah, well, I mean—
There's a hypothetical question.
It's a hypothetical question. I mean, you know, it's then I now start to get into some legal gray areas that might disappoint my financiers. So I'm going to tread carefully. But look, I think there's a real question as to whether this stuff causes promotion or dissolution. And I honestly don't believe we know the answer to that yet. I don't believe we know. I think the Wolverine case was interesting in the movie side where, you know, they really put the hammer to this guy who uploaded a copy of Wolverine. But the most of the statistics showed that it probably did more help to the movie's box office than hurt because of the free promotion. I'm not saying that I'm a piracy advocate. I don't love the idea of people, you know, stealing stuff. I believe people should pay for stuff, obviously. We all work very hard to make things and it needs to be part of the market. But I think we still live in a gray area in terms of really isolating who really is committing piracy here and who is actually doing more towards promotion and not really siphoning off enough to be of any harm.
Well, and as you say, these are big questions that we still don't really have the answer to. It's only been 10 years since, you know, well, a little more than 10 years now. But, you know, we're talking about technology that in the course of human history is really recent and that is you know, every time you turn around has like doubled and tripled in size.
Yes.
So the questions are not likely to have easy answers.
Absolutely not. And that's really why I wanted to make the documentary was, you know, I looked around and just felt at least maybe we can just add some small voice to the conversation, because I don't think that there are easy answers. I can't sit here and say, you know, I'm with the pirates or I'm with, you know, the record industry, or it's that black and white, because it isn't. I think that there are a lot of voices in the movie that make it clear, you know, people even surprisingly like Henry Rollins, who can argue very articulately for both sides.
Right, right.
It's not a black and white issue, without a doubt.
Well, you know, unfortunately for the guys from Napster, a lot of their inability to even get to the Supreme Court comes down to a single email and a single word in that single email, where they find,
Parker.
It's Parker, talking about, you know, keeping their users anonymous as they're sharing their files with each other.
Yeah.
And then in parentheses, you know, because it's a lot of pirated material.
Right. Exactly.
And there's that word, pirated. And that becomes the death knell for Napster.
Yes.
To the tune of how much money?
It's I spent a lot of time with people digging. We racked up about $500 million in settlement dollars.
Half a billion. B.
Yeah. Once all the dust, some of this is still going on. There are people that are still being sued and having money yanked out of them, specifically to Napster, not just, you know, RIA, you know, longstanding suits with users for downloading. It was a sinkhole of massive proportions.
Now, you know, as some of us will recall, Napster did try to revive itself as a legal licensing, you know, working with the industry sort of company. What happened to that?
Well, that really had nothing to do with Napster. The name, like Kleenex, was bought out of bankruptcy by another company, and they just used it. Mm-hmm. They slapped it on it still continues to this day to be slapped on. Shows you the strength of the brand onto all kinds of – I mean, I'll be surprised if I don't see a moped company called Napster eventually. It's just – it's sort of, you know, working its way down the chain of corporate branding. But the guys, when they went bankrupt, they were all done.
So where are they now?
Well, you know, they're two very bright, you know, Fanning and Parker, who, you know, were the co-founders, are they're all doing really well. All the guys are doing really well. They're really smart guys. You know, they were not they were very, you know, emotionally devastated by the experience. They were not cocky, arrogant anarchists. So, you know, I think they all spent a lot of time sort of just trying to recover. Took a few years, I think, for all of them. Fanning sold a gaming company to EA for $30 million. Parker has made a couple billion with his association with Facebook, and now he's one of the guys running Spotify with Daniel Ek. So, you know, these guys
When Justin Timberlake portrays you in on screen, you're doing okay.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
so
hopefully.
Sean Parker is the Justin Timberlake character
is
in Facebook
the social
movie,
network.
The social
That's
network.
Correct. Yeah.
So the guys are doing all right. The industry, as I said at the beginning of our conversation, now showing the slightest bit of growth in sales, and it's mainly because of digital sales. And I sort of come back to, you know, what I said at the beginning, which is I find the situation so frustrating that it took more than a decade for the digital side and the industry to learn to work together to where they're actually making it happen now.
Yeah.
Are you frustrated after telling this story?
I mean, I went into it frustrated and I've come out of it frustrated, but I wasn't looking to satisfy my frustration as much as, you know, make other people frustrated. Mm. There you go. There's the name. I think as you said, it's an enormous paradigm shift. I don't think we can really underestimate how big these changes are, and they're going to take time. I actually don't believe much is really getting worked out between the digital side and the existing establishment yet at all. I see this as micro steps forward that'll probably still have big steps backwards before the artist is being properly compensated,
right.
Which is really all that matters at the end of the day.
Right. So this is the big deal with the subscription services like Spotify. It's just,
where's artist development? Where's artist compensation? Those two questions should be at the front of any discussion about anything going forward.
Alex Winter is the director behind the new documentary Downloaded, about the history, the rise, and the spectacular fall of the file-sharing site known as Napster. It premiered yesterday at the South by Southwest Film Festival in Austin, Texas. Alex, it raises perhaps more questions than it answers. That's a job well done. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
This is Soundcheck.
Well, I got a fast connection.
I got beats on the brain and I just want to sing. Don't like moving, but I like traveling. Listen to me and the wisdom that I'm supposed to get through.
Is what's expected. Nothing is spoken or produced. Never got time for no excuses. You gotta go beyond. My flow is tomfoolery. I smoke this pork rapper so fast they call me charcuterie. I beautifully exude a vibe that's free of ambiguity. Your goonery, for the sake of goonery, is cartoons to me. It's coonery, it's lunacy. Let's make it plain. Only way that you hang is attached to a tree. The moon talk to the sea and speak a body language fluently. She make it rain.
Just announced, Brooklyn-based rapper Talib Kweli will join us in the green space on Wednesday, April 24th at 8 p.m., known for his work as a solo artist and as one half of the hip-hop duo Black Star. His fifth album, Prisoner of Conscience, is due out in May. Get your tickets to see him live on Wednesday, April 24th, in the green space at soundcheck.org. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. 5 years ago, guitarist and composer Matt Davis embarked on a project called City of Philadelphia 2008. Each month of that year, he interviewed members of various communities around Philly and then wrote music inspired by those conversations for his ensemble, Aerial Photograph. Now, Matt Davis has brought his ensemble and a new edition of his project here to New York. The group's with me in our studio today, and they're going to start us off with a selection from City of New York 2013. This is called Generational. It's the band Aerial Photograph, live on Soundcheck.
Many of the kids in the South Bronx neighborhood wouldn't venture into Manhattan. Black kids wouldn't come to Manhattan. Not like it is now. Mm-hmm. You knew you didn't belong there. You just, okay.
Right.
And you knew if you got on the train going north, all the white people got off by 96th Street. Mm-hmm. You didn't grow up during that time. Now you have a whole lot of white people live in Harlem and north of 96th Street. Mm-hmm. There was like a line of demarcation. You could get on the train. You could count on it. If you were looking for a seat to go to the Bronx and you were on the train, you knew all the white people would be off in 96th Street, so you stood in front of white people to get off the train. That was a reality in my growing up. So that's a whole other era that you don't know about. Where do you live now?
I live at 183 in Fort Washington.
Thank you.
that is a live performance by the band Aerial Photograph here in our soundcheck studio. Generational is the name of the song, and composed by Matt Davis, who was leading the band while playing the electric guitar. The other members of Aerial Photograph here with us today include the strings, Conchetta Abate and Curtis Stewart playing violin, Eric Lemon on viola, Bronwyn Bannert playing the cello, the horns, Paul Jones on sax, Jay Ratman on clarinet, Matt Holman on trumpet, and the rest of the rhythm section, Leon Boykins on bass, Justin Lee behind our drum kit. Matt Davis, welcome to Soundcheck.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for having the band.
So that's an interesting sound. I mean, you know, seeming to come out of a jazz tradition, but it sounds like it's a composed piece.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what Aerial Photograph is?
Yeah, it's sort of a mix between through composition and improvisation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's parts for both.
So at the beginning of that song, Generational, we hear a voice,
right.
Clearly from one of your interviews in this City of New York 2013 project.
Right, yeah.
Who is that, and what's the idea behind that first month of the project?
Every month is dedicated to a different group of people. And January was all about seniors and the elderly in New York City. And the suite of music I wrote, that was just one piece of, is called Elder City. And that was a woman I spoke to at the Lenox Hill House, which is a community center and senior center in the Upper East Side. And I spent mostly an afternoon there talking to one senior after another in this room. And they shared all kinds of stories about growing up in New York and how it's changed and how it's the same and how they feel about, you know, the way it is now and what it used to be. And it was a really awesome experience, and they had all kinds of really cool stories to share, and that was one of them.
So you collect all of these stories, you have all these voices on tape. What is it about that voice that inspired, and that story that inspired this music?
You know, sometimes it's not as clear cut as you know, speaking to someone and something they say specifically, like in that piece. There was sort of like when I was composing that piece, I was sort of thinking about some of the things that the group had said, really, at that center and also at some other ones. And one thing I sort of picked up on a lot of the conversations I had was this, the idea of repetition and routine. And some of the people I spoke to were in their 80s and 90s, and they had a routine more or less for like decades, you know, like 20, 30 years. Do this on Monday, do this on Wednesday, weekend, I do this, you know, whatever. And they just sort of got in this groove happening, you know? And after a long time of that happening, I sort of got the sense that, like, there was a real peace that was coming through in there in our conversations, you know?
A sense of comfort from that groove,
absolutely,
that routine.
Yeah.
And so you start the piece with a kind of a groove on the guitar.
Exactly, sort of just this is one of those pieces that's just more or less a repetition over and over and over again with variations.
So that was January's community.
Right. Yeah.
What did you do for February?
February was people in the city who are dealing with a drug addiction and recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to different people within that community and that field.
Right.
I went to an AA meeting and talked to some folks afterwards. I talked to a senior jazz musician who had sort of lived through the era of the music when drugs were sort of a part of the culture and the identity, and a woman who works at a methadone clinic,
mm-hmm.
and then also a woman who was going for her master's in psychology, but she was a recovering alcoholic and had a lot to share.
So each month it's a different community,
yep.
within the city.
Mm-hmm.
You did this in Philadelphia back in 2008.
Right.
And so how did that, I mean, is it essentially the same project transported to New York?
Yeah, little minor differences, but yeah, generally the same principle, same concept.
Mm-hmm. And where did the original idea come from?
It's hard to actually pinpoint where it comes from, because there were a lot of different things that were coming together for me to want to do this. One of the things, or two of the things rather, were we had a regular gig at this place in Philadelphia called the Tritone, which was on South Street. And we were playing every month, and I just figured, you know, 2008 was coming up, and maybe I should try to do something different for this year, you know, instead of just writing some pieces and keeping them in the mix for 6 months and then writing other pieces and having it be very loose. You know, as a composer and as a musician and a performing artist, I wanted to just try to push myself and do something different, you know. And I'm kind of fascinated by people and all the different ways we go through our lives, so I thought it would be kind of cool to bring that into the mix.
And so are the tapes, the so-called found sound, are they part of each month's suite
of
works?
Yeah, they're sort of integral. I mean, yeah. I try to get out early, talk to people the first week of the month, start writing music around that time. Second week, you know, third week, it's sort of done. We do the recording. We do a gig. We move on.
That's a lot of, that's a pretty compressed timeline.
Yeah,
how much music are you producing each month?
It varies. I'm thinking somewhere in the time, you know, it's like 20, 25 minutes of music for the group. Yeah.
Composed music.
Yeah.
All right. We're speaking with Matt Davis, the guitarist and leader of this band, Aerial Photograph. They're performing on Saturday, March 23rd at the Douglas Street Music Collective in Brooklyn, and obviously playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. So you're relatively new to New York. Is part of the attraction here that you get to go out and visit people and places in New York that you might not otherwise see?
Yeah. It was part of the attraction of Philadelphia. And I've been here for about 5 years now, so it's taken about 5 years to feel like kind of settled. You know, it's such a busy place and so much going on and getting pulled in so many different directions.
So where is this next piece? Is this part of your February collection?
No, you know what? This next piece is a piece from our back catalog. This is a piece I wrote called Nondum, and it was written, inspired by a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins, who's one of my favorite poets, and this really beautiful piece called Nondum.
So kind of, there's a kind of ecstatic sense to a lot of Manley Hopkins poetry.
Yeah, exactly, right.
Does that come out in this piece?
I hope so. That was sort of the intention.
All right.
Yeah.
Let's hear it.
Thanks.
Matt Davis picking up the electric guitar. The band is Aerial Photograph, and a live performance on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
That was a bit of the song Nondum by the group Aerial Photograph, led by guitarist and composer Matt Davis. You can listen to more music and conversation about the group's City of New York 2013 project on our website, soundcheck.org. Up next, let's face it, music can be a big distraction. But one startup is betting on music as a way to help you focus. We'll learn more about it after the break. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The Harley-Davidson Motor Company recently made news when it banned all music from its factory floors. No more headphones, no more radios, no more piped-in music. Now, of course, this ruffled some feathers, some rather large, burly ones. But let's face it, music can be distracting. But a new online music streaming service called Focus at Will is betting on music as a way to keep us focused, particularly when we're trying to read or study or work. Joining me now on the line is the founder of the service, Will Henschel. Will's a songwriter and, obviously, an entrepreneur. Will, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So Focus at Will is a new music service that you claim helps you focus and retain information when working, studying, writing, and reading. How does it do that?
Well, it turns out that two people out of three like to listen to music, intuitively like to listen to music while you are working, studying, reading, and writing. And in fact, if you look around at an airport or you just look around anywhere, you'll find a lot of people actually have earbuds in and they're listening to stuff while they're working.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that people intuitively like to do. Here's the extraordinarily different thing about why Focus at Will works. We found that the kind of music you need to listen to while you're working, the music that helps you focus and study, is exactly the opposite to music you can buy commercially.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why is it's designed to be engaging.
Right.
If you like the new U2 record, it's designed to inspire you. That can go. It moves you. Any music at all that you might want to listen to is designed to actually have a visceral emotional reaction on us. That's why we like it. So it turns out that music that works really well to help you concentrate while you're working, in other words, working in your subconscious while you're consciously doing something else, is different. And that music has to have, first of all, no vocals, and the qualities of that music has to be very specifically designed to help a little part of the brain called the limbic system.
This is the reptilian part of the brain, the very...
People call it that. It's not really accurately what happens while we're trying to concentrate on something, the part of our brain called the fight or flight mechanism, the limbic system, is always on the lookout for food and danger and opportunities to mate, incidentally.
You need to find music that will not kind of engage those really primal urges to mate or to find food or, you know, these really, as you say.
Yeah.
This sounds to me, Will, very reminiscent of what Brian Eno started doing back in the late 70s, early 80s with his ambient music, where his stated intention was for the music to be, and this is a quote, as ignorable as it is interesting. That's a little bit of Brian Eno's ambient music classic, Music for Airports. So, Will, is this ambient style of music the type that you use on your service?
You're right, apart from one thing. We have found that the exact recipe to make this kind of music is not ambient and is not ignorable. It turns out that if the music that you listen to is too forgettable, if it is elevator music, if it is purely ambient music, the part of your brain that we're talking about, the limbic system, will ignore it. So there is actually a new kind of music which we're calling productivity music, and it has to be engaging enough that the limbic system notices it, but it hasn't got to be, it mustn't be too engaging that it actually becomes distracting.
So does that mean you have to create this productivity music specifically for this purpose? Is this something that has existed before, or are you commissioning people to make it for you?
Both of the above, actually. Some of the music that we play on the Folks at Will service is music that we have found and edited and remixed.
So let's give people a chance to hear some of what you're talking about, Will. We're speaking with Will Henschel, the songwriter and founder of the new online music service Focus at Will. If you choose the acoustical setting on Focus at Will, these are some of the pieces of music that you'll hear. So if you choose the acoustical setting on the new streaming service Focus at Will, music that is supposed to help you focus and retain information, you might have heard, in that order, the pianists Liz Story, Richard Shulman, and Joe Bongiorno, and the group The Real Tuesday Weld. Now, Will, how do you figure out what needs, how to sequence the various pieces once you've chosen them?
Well, there are two things I'd like to say. One is that it is entirely counterintuitive for me to tell you this. If you like, say, acoustic piano music in the rest of your life, we recommend you do not listen to that music on our system. Mm. So there are eight or nine different genres on the system.
So why do you recommend that?
Well, what happens is if there's a certain genre of music you really like, it creates a dopamine response in your brain, mm-hmm. which can be distracting.
Okay.
So it's actually better off. You're better off listening to music of a genre that you don't usually listen to. The second thing is that it turns out this is all science-based. This is not superstition. everything that we do is science-based. And it turns out that human beings are exquisitely sensitive to the sequencing of different kinds of music in very specific orders. And I'll give you an example of how most people would understand that. You know, when you go to see a live show and the band do the wrong song? we've all seen that happen. And then they've lost the crowd. We've all seen that happen.
So they don't open with the right, the big opener, or maybe they don't hit the... They don't play the right song at the conclusion that sends you home.
You got it.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, you know that? So that is an example of how human beings are sensitive. Well, it turns out that when you're concentrating on something, your non-focal attention, which is this part of the brain, which is what we're playing music for, is incredibly and exquisitively sensitive to different pieces of music. And so we have our playlist sequencer, which is something called the Focus Genome Sequencer, which is the patented core process that drives the playlist for our system. What it's doing is it's choosing music based on very specific criteria over a period of time. We meta tag the songs. There are 40, 50 different meta tags that we actually assign to different pieces of music. And we found by playing specific key sequences, instrumentations, intensities. There's a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
We're able to sustain interest for your non-focal attention to be able to stop you being distracted by the things around you.
So if the music can engage this, as you call it, non-focal attention in your brain, it allows the part of the brain that you're trying to concentrate with on the task at hand, it allows that part of the brain a little more, it allows it more focus, more of a freedom of distraction from the rest of this non-focal stuff that's going on all the time in the background.
You know when you drive in and you have a bunch of kids in the back seat?
I do know that feeling.
Oh, yeah. Imagine being able to give all the kids in the back something to do so that they can be distracted so you can get on with driving on the road.
Right, right.
The limbic system is a little like that. It's a bunch of kids in the back seat trying to distract you while you're doing stuff.
So you said there's science behind this. There certainly has been so much neuroscience done in the last 20 years that looks at music and how our brain responds to music. This is really, I mean, you are really parsing bits of music for all these different attributes, key signature, rhythm, how it goes, and the flow of what comes before and after. How do you test that?
We have our own lab. We started in October in this last year. We started launching our first alpha with a couple of hundred people. And we have EEG machines, skin conductivity machines, heart rate variability machines, a number of other things. And we're able to test whether someone is focusing or not based on what their physiological signs are doing. And so we have a team of researchers. We have a doctor called Dr. Stephen Sidoroff, who's one of the UCLA psychology professors. He's running trials for us. And another team out of San Francisco, Dr. Evian Gordon, who's one of the leading researchers, on something called resilience. Now, resilience is a psychological term for how people get distracted at work. He's probably looking at me now going, what? But that is the simple version of what resilience is. It's to do with habituation and resilience. And so we have found by doing tests on resilience and habituation that it's possible to help, as I said, help turn off the fight or flight influence on the brain just a bit. And it doesn't need to be turned off that much to make a huge difference.
Now, you started by saying two out of three people. I'm one of those people that will, wherever I am, whatever music is playing, I'm noticing it, which is why I go crazy in shopping malls, especially around the holidays.
Yeah.
I can't turn that off. And I know other people who feel similarly about, you know.
You may be one of the two. You may be that one person out of three.
Okay.
The two people, the system has been shown to work pretty well on two people out of three. The people who it doesn't work for are people who typically are very, it's called hypervigilant, people who notice a lot of things all the time, people who are super conscious of, the extreme of this, of course, is someone with extreme ADD and ADHD, and at the extreme of that, it's somebody with autism, I guess, if you, mm-hmm. if you were to look all the way down the other spectrum. People who are not vigilant at all in terms of the way their brain works, it doesn't work so well for them so well either because they don't notice anything.
all right, so we got a kind of a bell curve, is what you're saying.
That's right. For most normal people, and you may not indeed be a normal person, for two people out of three, it seems to work pretty well.
Okay, now for you, Will, I mean, you've got this online music service called Focus at Will. How do you make a business out of this? How does this, you know, become a profit-making enterprise?
Absolutely. The business is going to be a subscription-based business. And a little like a lot of the net, the internet businesses, there will be a free and functional version, which anybody can use, then there are specific channels and specific elements of the technology which we will be charging people to use.
So right now it's right now you're in the kind of beta testing stage.
Yeah. And we're in the beta phase and will be for certainly another couple of months. Yes.
And folks, you can check it out online at focusatwill.com. Let us know, do you listen to music at work or while studying? And if so, what kinds of music do you find work for you? You can leave us a comment on our website, soundcheck.org. We've been speaking with Will Henschel, the songwriter and entrepreneur who is the founder of the new online music service called Focus at Will. And, Will, it's a really intriguing idea, and I can't wait to see it in action. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for calling.
This is Soundcheck. That's going to do it for Soundcheck today. On tomorrow's show, the late actor and director Dennis Hopper was known for his roles in films like Apocalypse Now and Easy Rider. But he used music to great effect in his own directing. We'll talk with the author of a new book called Hopper, A Journey into the American Dream. Plus, the South by Southwest Music Festival officially begins tomorrow in Austin, Texas. Soundcheck's digital producer Mike Katziff will be heading down there, and he'll tell us about the bands he's looking forward to seeing this year. And the band Eels stops by our studio to play music from their new album, Wonderful Glorious. All of that tomorrow at 9. I'm John Schaefer. Be with us then. This is Soundcheck.